When I spoke to you last, dear people of the internet, I told you all about the bear with whom I shared a face-to-face moment not long ago. So guess what I saw this time? A moose. An honest-to-God, scruffy, massive, stare-you-down, wiry-haired moose. And although this wasn't as fraught with potential altercation as the experience with the bear, this time, the moose just stood there, staring, impassive, unwilling to budge, as if to say, "Hell, I'm a moose, what are you going to do about it?" So that was exciting. Worth sharing, I hope, at least. And while there's no obvious correlation between the anecdote and today's story, I'm sure the intrepid among you can find a hidden connection somewhere, and I can't wait to hear it. So good evening, it's Wednesday, the 23rd of May 2007, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Everything by Ingeborg Bachmann. When we sit down to a meal like two people who have been turned to stone, or meet in the evening at the door of the apartment because we have both thought of bolting it at the same time, I feel our morning like a bow stretching from one end of the world to the other. That is to say, from Hannah to me. And to the bent bow is fitted an arrow that must strike the impassive sky in the heart. When we go back through the hall, she walks two steps in front of me. She goes into the bedroom without saying good night. And I flee into my room, to my typewriter, and then stare into space, her bowed head before my eyes and her silence in my ears. Is she lying down and trying to sleep? Or is she awake and waiting? What for, since she isn't waiting for me? When I married Hannah, it was less for her own sake than because she was expecting a baby. I had no choice, needed to make no decision. I was moved because something was in preparation that was new and came from us. And because the world seemed to me to be waxing, like the moon before, which one is supposed to bow three times when it is new and stands tender and breath-coloured at the start of its course. I experienced moments of absence I had not known before. Even in the office. Although I had enough to do, or during a conference, I would suddenly slip into this state in which I turned only to the child, to this unknown spectral being, and went towards it with all my thoughts, right into the warm, lightless womb in which it lay prisoner. The child we expected changed us. We scarcely went out any more and neglected our friends. We looked for a larger apartment and arranged our living conditions better and more permanently. But on account of the child I was waiting for, everything began to change for me. I came upon unexpected thoughts, as one comes upon minds, of such explosive power that I ought to have drawn back in terror, but I went on with no feeling for the danger. Hannah misunderstood me. Because I couldn't decide whether the baby carriage should have big or small wheels, I seemed indifferent. "I really don't know, whichever you like. Yes, I am listening." When I stood around with her in shops where she was searching for bonnets, jackets, and diapers, hesitating between pink and blue, synthetic wool and real wool, she reproached me with not having my mind on the subject. But it was only too much on it. How am I to express what was going on inside me? I was like a savage who is suddenly made aware that the world in which he moves between hearth and encampment, between sunrise and sunset, between hunting and eating, is also the world that is millions of years old and will pass away. That occupies an insignificant place among many solar systems, that rotates at a great speed on its axis, and at the same time round the sun. All at once I saw myself in other contexts, myself and the child whose turn to be born would come round at a particular point of time, the beginning or middle of November, just as it had once come for me, just as it had once come for all those before me. One just has to visualize it clearly, the whole line of descent, like the black and white sheep before you fall asleep, one black, one white, one black, one white, and so on. A mental image which can sometimes make one dull and drowsy and sometimes desperately wide awake. I have never been able to get to sleep by means of this prescription, although Hannah, who learnt it from her mother, swears that it is much more tranquilizing than a sleeping tablet. Perhaps it is tranquilizing to many people to think of this chain. Enchem beget Arphaxad, and Arphaxad lived 35 years and begat Sala, and Sala begat Eber, and Eber beget Peleg, and Peleg lived 30 years and begat Roy, and Roy begat Surug, and Surug begat Nahor, and each of them afterward begat many sons and daughters, and the sons kept begetting sons, to wit Nahor begat Terah, and Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. I tried 2 or 3 times to think this process through, not only forwards but also backwards to Adam and Eve, from whom we are unlikely to be descended. But in every case there is a darkness, so that it makes no difference whether we attach ourselves to Adam and Eve or to 2 other exemplars. Only if we don't want to attach ourselves and prefer to ask why each one had his turn, we find ourselves completely baffled by the chain, and don't know what to make of all the begettings of the first and last lives. For each person has only one turn at the game which he finds waiting for him, and is compelled to take up. Procreation and education. Economics and politics. And he is allowed to occupy himself with money and emotion, with work and invention, and the justification of the rules of the game, which is called thinking. But since we so trustingly multiply, we have to make the best of it. The game needs the players, or do the players need the game? I too had been put so trustingly into the world, and now I had put a child into the world. Now I trembled at the very thought. I began to look at everything in relation to the child, my hands, for example, which would one day touch and hold him, our apartment on the 3rd floor. The Candlegasse, the 7th district, the roads running this way and that way, through the city, down to the river meadows of the Prater, and finally the whole wide world, which I would explain to him. From me he should hear the names, table and bed, nose and foot. Also words like spirit and God and soul, in my view useless words, but they couldn't be hidden from him. And later, complicated words, like resonance, diapositive, chiliasm, and astronautics. I should have to see to it that my child learnt what everything meant and how everything was to be used, a door handle and a bicycle, a mouthwash and a form. It was all spinning round in my head. When the child came, of course, I could make no use of my great lesson. He lay there jaundiced, wrinkled, pitiful, and there was one thing I was not prepared for, that I had to give him a name. I hurriedly came to an agreement with Hannah, and we had 3 names entered in the register, my father's, her father's, and my grandfather's. None of these 3 names was ever used. By the end of the 1st week, the child was called Phipps. I don't know how this came about. Perhaps it was partly my fault, because I tried, like Hannah, who was quite inexhaustible in the invention and combination of meaningless syllables, to call him by pet names because his real names just didn't seem to fit the tiny naked creature. Various attempts at ingratiation produced this name that has annoyed me more and more with the passing of the years. Sometimes I even blamed it on the child, as though he could have defended himself, as though it was no coincidence. Phipps. I shall have to go on calling him that, making him ridiculous beyond death, and us with him. When Phipps lay in his blue and white cot, awake, asleep, and all I was good for was to wipe a few drops of saliva or sour milk from his mouth, to pick him up in the hope of giving him relief when he screamed, I thought to myself for the first time that he too had plans for me, but that he was allowing me time to get to the bottom of them, was altogether determined to allow me time like a ghost that appears to one and returns into the darkness and comes back, emitting the same unfathomable look. I often used to sit by his bed looking down at that almost immobile face, into those eyes that gazed without direction, and studying his features like an ancient script for whose decipherment there is no clue. I was glad to see that Hannah kept unerringly to the obvious things, feeding him, putting him to sleep, waking him, changing his bed and his diapers as laid down in the book. She cleaned his nose with little wads of cotton wool, and dusted a cloud of powder between his chubby thighs as though this were of everlasting benefit to him and to her. After a few weeks, I tried to entice a first smile out of him. But when he did surprise us with one, the grimace remained enigmatic and unrelated to us. Even when he directed his eyes more and more frequently and more exactly at us, or stretched out his little arms, I had a suspicion that it meant nothing, and that we were merely trying to find for him the reasons which he would later assume. It was impossible for Hannah, and perhaps for anybody, to understand me, but at this period my disquiet began. I'm afraid that I already started, then, to move away from Hannah, more and more to shut her out and keep her at a distance from my true thoughts. I discovered a weakness in myself. The child had made me discover it, and the feeling of moving towards a defeat. I was 30, like Hannah, who looked young and slender as never before, but the child had not given me any fresh youth. To the degree that his circle expanded, I contracted mine. I went to the wall at every smile, every exultation, every cry. I hadn't the strength to nip this smiling, this chirping, these cries in the bud, because that would have been the thing to do. The time that remained to me passed quickly. Phipps sat upright in the pram, cut his first teeth, moaned a great deal. Soon he stretched, stood up swaying, grew visibly steadier, crawled on his hands and knees across the room, and one day the first words came. There was no stopping it now, and I still didn't know what was to be done. What indeed? In the past I had thought I had to teach him the world. Since the mute dialogues with him, I had become confused and been taught otherwise. Did I not have it in my power, for example, to refrain from telling him the names of things, from teaching him the use of objects? He was the first man. With him everything started, and it was impossible to say whether everything might not become quite different through him. Should I not leave the world to him, blank and without meaning? I didn't have to initiate him into purposes and aims, into good and evil, into what really is and what only seems to be. Why should I draw him over to me? Why should I make him know and believe, rejoice and suffer? Here, where we are standing, the world is the worst of all worlds, and no one has understood it up to now. But where he was standing, nothing had been decided. Not yet. How much longer? And I suddenly knew. It is all a question of language, and not merely because of this one language of ours that was created with others in Babel to confuse the world. For underneath it, there smoulders another language that extends to gestures and looks, the unwinding of thoughts and the passage of feelings, and in it is all our misfortune. It was all a question of whether I could preserve the child from our language until he had established a new one and could introduce a new error. I often went out of the house alone with Phipps, and when I saw what Hannah had done to him in the way of sweet talk, coquetry, playfulness, I was horrified. He was taking after us. But not only after Hannah and me, no, after mankind in general. But there were moments in which he governed himself, and then I observed him earnestly. All paths were the same to him, all beings the same. Hannah and I undoubtedly stood closer to him, only because we were continually busying ourselves close to him. It was all the same to him. How much longer? He was afraid, not yet of an avalanche or a mean act, however, but of a leaf that started moving on a tree, of a butterfly. Flies utterly terrified him, and I thought, how will he be able to live when a whole tree bends in the wind, and I leave him so unclear about everything? He met a neighbour's child on the street. He clutched clumsily at his face, drew back, and perhaps didn't know that he was looking at a child. In the past he had screamed when he felt uncomfortable, but when he screamed now, Ma was involved. It often happened before he fell asleep, or when I picked him up to carry him to the table, or when a toy was taken away from him. There was a great rage in him. He could lie down on the floor, dig his nails into the carpet, and scream till he was blue in the face and frothing at the mouth. He used to scream out in his sleep as though a vampire had settled on his chest. These screams confirmed my opinion that he still trusted himself to scream, and that his screams worked. Oh, one day. Hannah went about with gentle reproaches and called him naughty. She pressed him to her, kissed him, or looked at him gravely, and told him not to distress his mother. She was a wonderful temptress. She stood unflinchingly bent over his nameless river and tried to draw him across. She walked up and down on our bank, enticing him with chocolates and oranges, tops and teddy bears. And when the trees cast shadows, I thought I heard a voice. Teach him the language of shadows. The world is an experiment, and it is enough that this experiment has always been repeated in the same way, with the same result. Make another experiment. Let him go to shadows. The result till now has been a life in guilt, love, and despair. I had begun to think of everything in universal terms, then words like this occurred to me. But I could spare him guilt, love, and any kind of fate, and free him for another life. Yes, on Saturdays I wandered with him through the Vienna woods, and when we came to a stream, a voice inside me said, "Teach him the language of water." It passed over stones, over roots. Teach him the language of stones. Plant his roots afresh. The leaves were falling because it was autumn again. Teach him the language of leaves. But since I knew and found no words of such languages, had only my own language, and could not pass beyond its frontiers, I carried him up and down the paths in silence, and back home, where he learnt to form sentences, and walked into the trap. He was already expressing wishes, uttering requests and orders, and talking for the sake of talking. On later Sunday walks, he tore out blades of grass, picked up worms, caught beetles. Now they were no longer all the same to him. He examined them, killed them if I didn't take them out of his hand in time. At home he took to pieces books and boxes and his string puppet. He grabbed everything, bit it, felt everything, threw it away or accepted it. Oh, one day he would know all about everything. During this period, when she was more communicative, Hannah often used to draw my attention to what Phipps said. She was enchanted with his innocent looks, innocent talk, and his doings. But I could see no innocence in the child at all, since he was no longer defenceless and dumb as during the first weeks. And then, no doubt, he wasn't innocent, but only incapable of expressing himself. A bundle of fine flesh and flax with thin breath, with an enormous dull head that took the edge off the world's messages like a lightning conductor. When he was older, Phipps was often allowed to play with other children in a blind alley near the house. Once, when I was coming home around midday, I saw him with three little boys catch water in a tin as it flowed along the gutter. Then they stood in a circle, talking. It looked like a consultation. This is how engineers consult together as to where they shall begin drilling, where they shall make the first hole. They squatted down on the pavement, and Phipps, who held the tin, was on the point of emptying it out when they stood up again and moved three paving stones farther on. But this spot seemed not to be right either for what they had in mind. They stood up again. There was a tension in the air. What a male tension! Something had to happen. Then they found the spot 3 feet farther on. They squatted down again, fell silent, and Phipps tipped the tin. The dirty water flowed over the paving stones. They stared at it, silent and solemn. It was done, accomplished, perhaps successful. It must have been successful. The world could rely on these little men who were carrying it on. They would carry it on. Of that I was now quite sure. I entered the house, mounted the stairs, and threw myself on the bed in our bedroom. The world had been carried forward. The spot had been formed from which to carry it forward, always in the same direction. I had hoped that my child would not find the direction, and once, a long time ago, I had feared that he would not find his way. Fool that I was, I had feared that he wouldn't find the direction. I got up and splashed a few handfuls of cold tap water over my face. I didn't want this child any more. I hated him because he understood too well, because I already saw him treading in everyone's footsteps. I walked around extending my hatred to everything that came of man, to the trams, the house numbers, titles, the division of time, this whole jumbled, ingenuous chaos that is called order. To refuse disposal, lecture lists, registration offices, all these wretched institutions against which it is no longer possible to kick, against which nobody ever does kick, these altars on which I had sacrificed but wasn't willing to let my child be sacrificed. Why should he be? He hadn't arranged the world, hadn't caused its injury. Why should he settle down in it? I yelled at the registration office and the schools and the barracks. Give him a chance. Give my child before he's ruined one single chance. I raged against myself because I had forced my son into this world and was doing nothing to set him free. I owed it to him. I had to act, go away with him, withdraw with him to an island. But where is this island from which a new human being can found a new world? I was caught with the child and condemned from the outset to join in the old. Therefore I dropped the child. I dropped him from my love. This child was capable of anything, only not of stepping out, not of breaking through the devil's circle. Phipps played away the years till he went to school. He played them away in the truest sense of the world. I was glad to see him play, but not those games that showed him the way to later games. Hide-and-seek, counting games, cops and robbers, I wanted quite different, pure games for him, other fairy stories than the familiar ones. But I couldn't think of anything, and he was only interested in imitation. One doesn't believe it possible, but there is no way out for us. Again and again, everything is divided into above and below, good and evil, light and dark, into quantity and quality, friend and enemy, and where other beings or animals appear in the fables, they immediately take on the features of human beings. Because I no longer knew how and to what purpose to educate him, I gave it up. Hannah noticed that I no longer bothered about him. Once we tried to talk about it, and she stared at me as if I were a monster. I couldn't get everything out because she stood up, cut me short, and went into the nursery. It was evening, and from that evening on, she, who formerly would no more have thought of it than I, began to pray with the child. Now I lay me down to sleep, little Jesus, meek and mild, and so on. I didn't bother about that either, but they will have gone a long way with their repertoire. I think she wanted thereby to put him under protection. Anything would have done for her, a cross or a mascot, a magic formula, or anything else. Fundamentally, she was right, since Phipps would soon fall among the wolves and soon howl with the wolves. God be with you was perhaps the last chance. We were both delivering him up, each in his own way. When Phipps came home from school with bad marks, I didn't say a word, but nor did I comfort him. Hannah was secretly anguished. She regularly sat down after lunch and helped him with his homework, heard him on his lessons. She did her job as well as it could be done, but I didn't believe in the cause. It was all the same to me whether Phipps went to the grammar school later or not, whether he developed into something worthwhile or not. A worker wants to see his son a doctor. A doctor wants to see his son at least a doctor. I don't understand that. I didn't want Phipps to become either cleverer or better than us, nor did I want to be loved by him. There was no need for him to obey me, no need for him to bend to my will. No. I only wanted him to begin from the beginning, to show me with a single gesture that he didn't have to reflect our gestures. I didn't see anything new in him. I was newborn, but he wasn't. It was I. Yes, I was the first man, and had gambled everything away and done nothing. I wanted nothing for Phipps, absolutely nothing at all. I merely went on observing him. I don't know whether a man has a right to observe his own child like this, as a research worker observes a case. I watched this hopeless case of human being, this child whom I couldn't love as I loved Hannah, Hannah whom I never dropped completely because she couldn't disappoint me. She had already been one of the same kind of people as myself when I met her, with a good figure, experienced, slightly special and yet not special, a woman, and then my wife. I put this child and myself on trial, him because he was destroying a lofty expectation, myself because I could not prepare the ground for him. I had expected that this child, because he was a child, yes, I had expected him to redeem the world. It sounds monstrous, and I did indeed behave monstrously towards the child, but there is nothing monstrous about what I hoped for. It was simply that I wasn't prepared for the child, like everyone before me. I had no thought in my mind when I embraced Hannah, when I was soothed in the darkness of her body. I couldn't think. It was good to marry Hannah, not only on account of the child, but later I was never again happy with her, but only concerned that she shouldn't have another. She wanted one. I have reason to believe that, although she no longer talks about it now and does nothing to make it happen. One might imagine that now of all times Hannah would think about a child, but she is turned to stone. She doesn't go away from me and doesn't come to me. She bickers with me in a way one ought never to bicker with anyone, since a man is not master over such intangible things as life and death. All that time, she would have liked to bring up a whole litter, and I prevented it. All the conditions were right for her, and none of them were right for me. She once explained to me, when we were quarrelling, all the things she wanted to do and have for Phipps. Everything. A lighter room, more vitamins, a sailor suit, more love, all the love there was. She wanted to set up a storehouse of love that would last a lifetime, because of outside, because of people, a good education, foreign languages, to watch out for his talents. She cried, and was offended because I laughed at this. I don't believe it occurred to her for a moment that Phipps would be one of the people outside, and that, like them, he might wound, insult, cheat, that he might be capable of so much as one mean action, and yet I had every reason to assume that he would. For evil, as we call it, was present in the child like an abscess in the body. I don't even need to think of the story of the knife here. It began much earlier, when he was 3 or 4. I came in when he was stamping round angry and snivelling. A tower he had built with bricks had fallen over. Suddenly he stopped his lamenting and said in a low, emphatic voice, "I'll set the house on fire. I'll smash everything to bits. I'll smash you all to bits." I lifted him up onto my knee, caressed him, promised to rebuild the tower for him. He repeated his threats. Hannah, who joined us, was for the first time unsure. She reproved him and asked him who said such things to him. He replied firmly, "Nobody." Then he pushed a little girl who lived in the building down the stairs, was very frightened afterwards, wept, promised never to do it again, and yet did it again. For a time he hit out at Hannah at every opportunity. This too passed. Of course I forget to bear in mind how many charming things he said, how affectionate he could be, how pink and glowing he was when he woke in the morning. I often noticed all that, was often tempted to snatch him up, to kiss him as Hannah did, but I didn't want to let myself be reassured and deceived by this. I was on the alert, because there was nothing monstrous about what I hoped for. I had no grandiose plans for my child, but I did want this little thing, this slight deviation. Of course, when a child is called Phipps, must he do such honour to his name, to to come and go with a lapdog's name. To waste 11 years in one circus act after another. Eat with the right hand. Hold yourself straight when you walk. Wave. Don't talk with your mouth full. After he went to school, I was more often to be found out of the house than in it. I played chess in a cafe, or, on the pretext of work, I shut myself up in my room and I read. I met Betty, a salesgirl from the Maria Hilferstrasse, to whom I brought stockings, movie tickets, or something to eat, and so got her used to me. She was offhand, undemanding, subservient, and if she enjoyed anything during her joyless free evenings, it was eating. I went to her pretty orphan throughout 1 year, lay down beside her on the bed in her furnished room where, as I drank a glass of wine, she read illustrated papers, and then agreed to my suggestions without embarrassment. It was a time of the greatest confusion because of the child. I never made love to Betty. On the contrary, I was on the search for self-gratification, for the prohibited, light-shunning liberation from woman and the human race, in order not to be caught, in order to be independent. I didn't want to sleep with Hannah any more, because I had given in to her. Although I had not tried to conceal my evenings away from home over such a long period, it seemed to me that Hannah lived without suspicion. One day I discovered that it was not so. She had already seen me once with Betty in the Café Elsehof, where we often used to meet after work, and again 2 days later when I was standing with Betty in a line for tickets outside the Cosmos Cinema. Hannah behaved in a very unusual way, looking past me as though I were a stranger, so that I didn't know what to do. I nodded to her, feeling paralyzed, and shifted forward to the box office, feeling Betty's hand in mine, and, incredible as it seems to me now, actually went into the movie theater. After the performance, while I prepared for reproaches and tested out my defense, I took a taxi for the short way home. As if I could thereby make reparation or prevent something. Since Hannah didn't say a word, I plunged into my prepared text. She maintained a stubborn silence, as though I were speaking of things that didn't concern her. Finally, she did open her mouth and said shyly that I should think of the child. "For Phipps' sake," was the expression she used. I was stricken because of her embarrassment, begged her forgiveness, went down on my knees, promised never again, and I really did never see Betty again. I don't know why. I nevertheless wrote her 2 letters, to which she undoubtedly attached no importance. No answer came, and in fact I hadn't expected an answer, as though I had wanted these letters to come to myself or Hannah. I had laid myself bare in them, as never before to anyone. Sometimes I feared to be blackmailed by Betty. Why blackmailed? I sent her money. Why? Since Hannah knew about her. This bewilderment, this desolation. I felt extinct as a man, impotent. I wanted to remain so. If a bill were presented, it would go in my favour, to withdraw from the human race, to come to an end, let it come to that. But everything that happened was not a matter of me, or Hannah, or Phipps, but of father and son. A guilt and a death. I once read a book, and in it the sentence, "It is not heaven's way to raise its head." It would be a good thing if everyone knew of the sentence that speaks of the hardness of heaven, Oh, no, it really isn't heaven's way to look down, to give signs to the bewildered people below it. At least not where such a sombre drama takes place, in which it, too, this fabricated above, plays a part. Father and son. A son, that such a thing exists, that is what is inconceivable. Words like this occur to me now, because there is no lucid word for this gloomy business. Merely to think about it deprives one of one's reason. A gloomy business, for there was my seed, indefinable and uncanny to me myself, and then Hannah's blood in which the child was nourished and which accompanied the birth, altogether a gloomy business. And it had ended with blood, with his resoundingly brilliant child's blood that flowed from the wound in his head. He couldn't speak as he lay there on the jutting crag in the ravine. All he managed to get out was the name of the first schoolboy who reached him. He tried to raise his hand, to make some sign to him or to cling to him, but the hand wouldn't rise. In the end, however, a few moments later when the teacher bent over him, he did manage to say, "I want to go home." I shall take care not to believe, on the strength of this sentence, that he felt an explicit longing for Hannah and me. One wants to go home when one feels that one is dying, and he did feel that. He was a child and had no great messages to leave. Phipps was only a quite ordinary child. There was nothing to block his path, as he thought his last thoughts. The other children and the teacher collected sticks, made a stretcher of them, and carried him to the upper village. He died on the way, almost at the first few steps. Passed away, departed his life. In the obituary notice we wrote, "Our only child was taken from us by an accident." The man at the printer's who took the order asked if we didn't want to say, "Our only dearly beloved child." But Hannah, who was on the telephone, said no. That went without saying, beloved and dearly beloved, and that was no longer the point. I was so foolish as to try and embrace her for this statement, so morbid were my feelings for her. She pushed me away. Does she see me at all? What in heaven's name does she reproach me with? Hannah, who for a long time had cared for him entirely on her own, goes around looking unrecognizable, as though no longer lit by the searchlight that she shone upon her when she stood with Phipps, and threw Phipps in the centre of the stage. There is no longer anything to be said about her, as though she had neither qualities nor characteristics. In the past, she was gay and lively, anxious, gentle and strict, always ready to guide the child, to let him run and pull him back close to her. After the incident with the knife, for instance, she had her finest hour. She glowed with magnanimity and insight. She was able to take the part of the child and his faults. She stood up for him in front of every authority. It was his third year at school. Phipps had gone for a schoolfellow with a pocket knife. He tried to stab him in the chest. The knife slipped and went into the child's arm. We were called to the school, and I had painful discussions with the headmaster and the teachers and the parents of the injured child. Painful because I had no doubt that Phipps was quite capable of doing this and quite different things. But I couldn't say what I thought. Painful because the views that were forced upon me didn't interest me in the least. It wasn't clear to anybody what we ought to do with Phipps. He sobbed, now obstinate, now in despair, and if it is possible to draw a conclusion, then he regretted what had happened. Nevertheless, but did not succeed in persuading him to go voluntarily to the child and beg his pardon. We forced him, and all three of us went to the hospital. But I believe that Phipps, who had nothing against the child when he attacked him, began to hate him from the moment when he had to say his piece. It was no childish anger that was in him, but a very fine, very adult hate held down with great self-control. He had succeeded in developing a difficult emotion into which he let no one see. It was as if he had been struck into humanity. Every time I think of the school outing, in the course of which everything came to an end, I also remember the business with the knife, as if there were some remote connection between them, because of the shock that once more reminded me of the existence of my child. For apart from these two incidents, the few school years appear empty in my recollection, because I paid no attention to his growing up, to the increasing lucidity of his intelligence and his sensibilities. He must have been like all children of that age, wild and gentle, noisy and taciturn. Exceptional in Hannah's eyes. Unique in Hannah's eyes. The headmaster of the school phoned me at my office. This had never happened before. Even when the affair with the knife took place, they had phoned the flat, and it was Hannah who got in touch with me. I met the man half an hour later in the firm's entrance hall. We crossed the street to a cafe on the other side. First, he tried to say what had happened in the hall, then in the street, but even in the cafe he felt it wasn't the proper place. Perhaps there is no proper place for the announcement that a child is dead. It wasn't the teacher's fault, he said. I nodded. I had no wish to disagree. The condition of the path was good, but Phipps had broken away from the class, out of exuberance or curiosity, perhaps because he wanted to look for a stick. The headmaster began to stammer. Phipps had slipped on a rock and crashed down onto the one beneath. The wound in his head had not been serious in itself, but the doctor had discovered the reason for his rapid death. A cyst, I probably knew. I nodded. Cyst? I didn't know what it was. The school was profoundly affected, said the headmaster. A commission of inquiry had been set up. The police informed. I wasn't thinking of Phipps, but of the teacher, for whom I felt sorry, and I gave the headmaster to understand that there was nothing to fear from my side. No one was to blame. No one. I rose before we had time to order anything, put a shilling on the table, and we parted. I went back into the office, and away again at once to the cafe, to drink a coffee after all, although I would have preferred a brandy or a whiskey. I didn't trust myself to drink a brandy. Midday had come and I had to go home and tell Hannah. I don't know how I managed or what I said. While we walked away from the door of the apartment and through the hall, she must have already realized. Things moved so fast, I had to put her to bed and call the doctor. She was out of her mind, and until she lost consciousness, she screamed. She screamed as terribly as at his birth, and I trembled for her again as I had then. Once again I wished that nothing should happen to Hannah. All the time I thought, Hannah, never of the child. During the days that followed, I trod all the paths alone. At the cemetery, I had kept the time of the funeral secret from Hannah. The headmaster made a speech. It was a fine day. A light wind was blowing. The boughs on the wreaths rose as though for a festival. The headmaster talked on and on. For the first time, I saw the whole class, the children with whom Phipps had spent half of almost every day, a collection of little lads staring dully in front of them, and among them I knew there was one whom Phipps had tried to stab. There is an inner coldness that makes what is nearest and what is farthest move simultaneously into the distance. The grave moved into the distance with those standing round it and the wreaths. I saw the whole central cemetery drift away to the east, and while people were still squeezing my hand, I felt only squeeze after squeeze and saw the faces out there, precise, and as though seen from close to, but very far away. Tremendously far away. Learn the language of shadows. Learn it yourself. But now that it is all over, and Hannah no longer sits for hours in his room, but has allowed me to lock the door through which he so often ran, I sometimes speak to him in the language that I cannot consider good. My wild one, my heart. I'm ready to carry him on my back, and I promise him a blue balloon, a boat trip on the old Danube, and postage stamps. I blow on his knee when he has bumped himself, and help him with his sums. Even if I cannot thereby bring him back to life, it is not too late to think, I have accepted him, this son. I couldn't be friendly to him because I went too far with him. Don't go too far. First learn to walk forward. Learn it yourself. But first, one has to be able to tear to pieces the bow of sorrow that leads from a man to a woman. This distance, measurable with silence, how can it ever decrease? For time without end, where for me there is a minefield, there will be a garden for Hannah. I no longer think, but would like to stand up, cross the dark passage, and, without saying a word, reach Hannah. I look at nothing that would serve this purpose, neither my hands that are to hold her, nor my mouth in which I can enclose hers. It is unimportant with what sound before each word I come to her, with what warmth before each act of sympathy. I would not go in order to have her back, but in order to keep her in the world, and so that she should keep me in the world, through union. Mild and sombre. If there are children after this embrace, good, let them come, be there, grow up, become like all the others. I shall devour them like Cronos, beat them like a big terrible father, spoil them, these sacred animals, and let myself be deceived like a Lear. I shall bring them up as the times demand, half aiming as the wolfish practice, and half at the idea of morality, and I shall give them nothing to take on their way. Like a man of my times, no possessions, no good advice. But I don't know whether Hannah is still awake. I am no longer thinking. The flesh is strong and dark that buries a true feeling under the great laughter of night. I don't know whether Hannah is still awake.